Welcome to another episode of Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the podcast where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I am your host, Allison with a Y, here with my co-hosts, Allison with an I.
Hey.
And Patrick with a P.
Hello.
This week, I chose the Netflix original, Vampires versus the Bronx. So Vampires versus the Bronx is a horror comedy that digs into the real life issue of gentrification by portraying predatory real estate investors in the Bronx as literal vampires. As a sinister company called Murnau Properties, loved that, slowly transforms long-standing neighborhood businesses into hipster hangouts, a young Bronx resident known as Lil Mayor spearheads a campaign to keep his friend Tony's beloved local bodega open. But as Lil Mayor and his friends, Bobby and Luis, investigate Murnau Properties' shady dealings, they realize they're going to need wooden stakes, silver bullets, and a DVD copy of Blade to take their neighborhood back.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, great premise. Okay, right off the bat, loved Murnau Properties as an entity.
Mm-hmm.
Loved that the insignia sign, whatever, was Vlad Dracula.
Oh, is that what that was? Yeah. I didn't recognize the insignia. It looked like a king on a playing card
close enough. But yeah, that was definitely Vlad the Impaler.
Nice. Yeah, and of course, Murnau, for the uninitiated, was the director of Nosferatu.
Mm-hmm. The original Nosferatu.
Original Nosferatu, yeah. Not the Bill Skarsgård version. Yeah, I was really excited that you picked this, actually, because weirdly, this has been on my short list for like a long time.
Mm.
I keep a Google Doc that I check only occasionally when I need like an idea of a movie to pick for this podcast. And this has just been sitting on there for so long. Cause I was like, and I didn't know anything about it, honestly. I was just like, that's a good title. That title has my interest. So I'm glad you finally pulled the trigger on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I knew much about it either, but it seemed familiar when I started it. Like I had heard about it at one point and then it just got lost in the ether of my brain. But what made you pick this movie?
Great question. I had heard a lot about it when it came out. It was like a pretty big deal. It got quite a bit of buzz when it landed on Netflix in 2020. And it was just one of those movies that I always kind of wanted to watch and never got around to. So when I was looking for the next thing to pick and I saw that title, I was like, I've been wanting to watch that for years. And at first, I thought maybe they had already done it for the podcast because it feels like y'all would have done that for the podcast. And so I double checked with Patrick and he confirmed that no, they hadn't. And I was like, well, yeah, it's a crime that this hasn't been reviewed for the podcast sooner.
Did this come out January or February of 2020 or March or later in the year?
I haven't the foggiest.
Yeah. Because if it was January or February, I understand why I didn't watch it. But if it was March or later, I'm like, you were sitting on your ass looking for shit to do all the time. Why didn't you watch this movie in 2020?
Yeah, I almost said they didn't make any COVID references, but they wouldn't have if it came out in March because that's when COVID lockdown started.
October 2nd, 2020. Halloween season release. Spooky season release.
Yeah. And produced, directed by Lorne Michaels, surprisingly.
Not directed, produced.
Produced. Okay, produced.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
But I don't think I've seen his name on many things other than SNL.
I feel like I've seen him produce a handful of movies here and there, but yeah, I don't think of him as like a prolific movie producer by any means. It was a fun little surprise to see his name in the credits.
I think he produces more than you realize.
Does he?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he produces a lot of comedy films, especially if they involve any SNL cast members.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was surprised that he produced this one because it involves zero SNL cast members, past or present. or future.
Yeah. So actually, I just found out the writer-director of this movie, Oz Rodriguez, is the SNL connection. He was a segment director and producer at SNL. And according to this website, I don't know if has been is still true, like if he's still part of it or if this is in the past, but he was with the show for nearly a decade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he's got sort of deep connections to that world, which is pretty interesting. Also a Funny or Die guy, too. Wrote and directed some Funny or Die content. But yeah. A couple of notable names show up here and there, including Zoe Saldana in a very short-lived appearance in the very first scene. What other movie were we talking about that trope recently where you have, like, a notable actor who gets killed off? Afraid. Oh, Psycho.
Oh,
wait, what did you say?
I thought Afraid when Ricky Lindholm showed up at the beginning and we were like, oh, she's gone. She wasn't.
Kind of, yeah. I was thinking of Janet Leigh in Psycho, but yeah, I guess we've had a couple of those lately. But yeah, this is another one. She's selling her nail salon and talking to a seemingly nice, young, pretty white woman named Vivian, who has just moved into the neighborhood and seems to be pretty chill. Vivian comes back later. We'll talk more about her later. But yeah, vampire comes in to sign the paperwork on Becky's nail salon, which she is selling as the neighborhood gentrifies, and then vampire fucking sucks her blood out.
Yeah, I thought we'd see more of Zoe Saldana as the movie went on, but truly she was just in that one first scene.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was surprising.
It's a smart move. Again, we've discussed this trope quite a bit recently, but I always like it, honestly. It always gets me. And I mean, for something like this that probably had a relatively small budget and didn't have the budget to hire Zoe Saldana for more than a day of shooting, probably also smart. And also cool that Zoe Saldana was like, yeah, I like this concept. I'm going to do this.
Yeah. I like to see bigger actors do kind of small roles in smaller films just because it's something that they like find fun and they want to be a part of the project in some way.
Yeah, but most of this movie is the kids show. It's it's like a almost like a Stand By Me, Stranger Things kind of kids riding their bikes around the neighborhood and investigating creepy evil doings and setting out to put a stop to them, which I again, another sort of trope that I tend to enjoy if it's done well.
Yeah. I agree.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I liked that concept with this because I think people of many ages can watch this and enjoy this, but it also feels very age appropriate for the target age of, like, the characters, the kids.
Yeah, actually, that's true. I hadn't really thought about that, but I guess there's, you know, there's scary stuff, but there's nothing, like, super gory or violent in the movie. I don't recall there being much language.
No. There was one that's interesting. Because you can have one in a PG-13 movie.
There was a fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I forget where it was, but it was like very well placed.
Yeah. Well, we can't forget about my personal favorite member of the Wu-Tang Clan, Method Man.
Yeah.
When he showed up. Yeah. When he showed up early in the film, I cheered out loud.
Yeah. Yeah. He's just like a super straight-laced preacher who is like trying to keep the kids in line all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
funny. He was delightful. It's a big ensemble-y kind of cast, really. Like, it's anchored by, like, these three kids, and specifically, like, Lil Mare is definitely the protagonist. But I, you know, it kept reminding me of Do the Right Thing in a weird way, where it's like, you know, it takes place in the hood, in New York, and you're just getting a real slice of life through, like, a zillion little supporting characters who sort of pop in and out over the course of the movie. Which is fun, and I think goes a long way towards giving you a sense of the community and what's going on in this neighborhood and feeling like you're there.
Yeah, there was such a sense of pride, too, which very well encapsulated the spirit of the Bronx. I actually almost went to college in the Bronx. It was my number two pick. And they really do have, I mean, there's such rich culture there, and there's such a proud, like, borough, you know. And I felt like it was very, like, almost a love letter, you know, to the Bronx. I felt like it was not, like, the Bronx playing the Bronx. It was just, like, that's what this is, you know?
It reminded me of similar vibes that In the Heights had, of that sort of like neighborhood. All of these people from like different cultures like living together and creating their own unique culture together while still celebrating sort of the roots from where they came from.
Yeah, it didn't feel written or cast for kind of your standard like Hollywood palatability, especially, you know, I think it's frankly just kind of notable that this movie has like some dark skinned black people in it.
Yeah.
Because I mean, Hollywood tends to cast medium or light, like that's the whole thing, you know. And I like that this movie kind of like shows the full range of experience of people of color in this neighborhood, and puts people on screen that you don't often see on screen, which is fucking bizarre that you don't see them on screen at this point in time.
Right.
Like it's sort of insane that that still happens, but. It was cool. That was a cool thing about this movie.
Like, Lil Mayer is an interesting character, and I loved the lead, Lil Mayer, being a kid who, I think, presumably, was half black, half Latino.
Right, because his name is Miguel.
And you don't really get that, and you don't necessarily get that where it's acknowledged that that the character is anything but black. You know, it's usually like you have to be one or the other. And obviously, like to real people, that's not the case when they're celebrating and living in like the cultures that they come from. But you just don't really see that as a main character. It was nice. It was unique.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And these kids were good actors. You know, they did well. Like they kept me engaged. I looked forward to seeing what happened to them. And I mean, if we're not going to get Stranger Things for 100 years, I mean, it's coming, but.
I don't know if I even like want it anymore.
Oh, my God. I need like a whole season just reminder of what even happened.
Exactly. Exactly.
But these kids were good little actors, and they played kind of like, you know, there were some complex situations that they were in, like socially, you know, like Bobby being kind of like groomed by the local like gangbangers to eventually become a gangbanger himself, and like that's a really nuanced and kind of heavy like storyline to have a kid act, and I thought he did great, you know.
Yeah, I mean, also there's like a certain degree of radicalism, I guess, even just having one of these Stand By Me type movies that is anchored by all kids of color. Because I feel like even that archetype is so like dominated by like the Midwest white kids, like Norman Rockwell kind of vision. And like Stranger Things certainly has, you know, one or two kids of color in the like main group. But I don't know. I feel like you don't often see that kind of vibe with all young people of color.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is because it's also a trope that you don't really see in cities in film. Like it's like a suburb or a country.
Yeah.
Or a country, yeah.
Kind of vibe, not like a inner city sort of story.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's interesting as we're talking about this. A lot of this is occurring to me on the spot, you know, and I think that speaks to the film being sort of quietly radical in a lot of ways, because it's mostly a light, fun horror comedy that, you know, as you said, why, like, I think could be enjoyed by a lot of different people. I think there's plenty for adults to enjoy here, but I mean, you had a good point about like kids, the age of the kids in this movie, it would work for them too, even if you have parents who are like, you know, you're not watching like a gory horror movie, like this will still work. Like it feels light, it feels breezy, even though there's a lot of political content to it. Like the whole concept is a fucking political allegory. It goes down easy, but there's a lot of like very low key kind of radical elements to this that are kind of cool.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, so talking about the political underpinnings, Patrick, you got your gentrification movie.
Yeah, I was going to say we got two gentrification discussions back to back here, Barbarian and now this.
Yeah. I was just going to say that the taking of the process of gentrification and some of the businesses that ended up being posted there were very
funny. The funniest
funny.
Shit in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So funny and so fucking accurate for all these like hyper niche little hipster shops. What was the one that you cackled at, Patrick?
Oh, I mean, we should like sort of explain very briefly. Like, it's kind of a running gag that whenever a building gets taken over, you know, the windows get papered over, boarded up, whatever. And then there's like a series of signs that you see throughout the movie for the businesses that are going to replace the long time, you know, nail salon or bodega or whatever. And the one that got me the most was a sign for coming soon. I think it literally just said the butter store.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was like artisanal small batch butters and spreads, which is so on point. There was like one for a place called like Bone and Thread or something, yes. I think. And the characters are like, is this a restaurant or like
a clothing store?
Yeah, it's impossible to tell. It's such on point satire of, you know, these like, they're not even like upscale businesses that have become so popular over the last like 10 years that I feel like are mostly catered towards like our age group, you know. They're catering to like upper middle class or like lower middle class folks who want to feel upper middle class by going somewhere that has like this sort of air of mystique where it's like, what does Bone and Thread mean? You know, like, oh yeah, I can treat myself to an artisanal fucking butter spread. Like, I owe it to myself to go down to the Bronx and, you know, check that out. It was fucking perfect.
Yeah, I could picture the writers just like giggling as they were coming up with these ridiculous store names.
Yeah.
Oh, that writer's room must have been amazing.
Yeah.
I loved the portrayal of the bodega, which acts as like the centerpiece of Lil Mayer's campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't mean to make that pun, to save this beloved bodega. And it's just so incredibly accurate for like what New York bodegas are and what they do and like how they are cornerstones of so many communities. I have like a favorite TikTok account that I follow, and Allison with a Y, I don't know if you've seen this guy, but he's a bodega owner and all the local kids come in and bring him their report cards. And he hooks them up with stuff, you know, he hooks their families up with, well, no. So one of the sweetest things that I saw was he was like, you got $150 to spend on whatever you want. And these kids go and get like the first things that they get are like milk and bread and eggs and like stuff that their family needs. And he's like, come on, little man, like go get some stuff for yourself. And this guy, like they just did sort of a feature on him. I don't totally remember where, but he's like helped kids get through graduation by just like boosting them up. And like, you know, like he is a babysitter of sorts, much like Tony is in this movie, Tony, the owner of the bodega. And I just thought that was such a great, I don't know, like accurate, beautiful kind of tribute to the culture that is bodegas in New York. I really had a soft spot for that, like that storyline.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just another very endearing character. You know, we've mentioned a few notable names in this movie, but most of the actors are not anyone I'd ever heard of before. I'd never heard of this actor who plays Tony, and just very endearing character.
Yeah.
You know, you really get attached to him immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the little gags written into the movie around the bodega that made me cackle was in the beginning there was a bodega cat because there has to be a bodega cat. And then after, you know, the neighborhood starts getting gentrified, Tony says, oh yeah, the health department came through. I had to get rid of the cat. Like it was just, but
classic,
which was, yeah, like really sad. But I, you know, the nod to the essential bodega cat.
Yeah.
Was wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, I thought it was all very on the nose, like, again, portraying the Bronx as, you know, really what it is and not a tropey, like, exploited version of the Bronx. There were a couple scenes that cracked me up. Like, it was a very funny movie, in my opinion. Like, it's rare for me to laugh out loud during a movie. Like, I laugh internally, right? But, like, to get an LOL from me is rare. One of the scenes where we first see the vampire, one of the vampires in the horde who's got the long blonde hair and he's very, like, quintessential what a vampire would look. And one of the guys that's like hanging out on the corner wearing his basketball jersey that's customized with his name on the back. It's a Knicks jersey. He like the vampire corners him in a parking garage and this guy just starts ripping on his clothes. And it was just hilarious to me. He's like, "What are you wearing?" And he was like, "This is a custom blah 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 from France, circa like 1650. Thank you." And he's like, "I wasn't complimenting you." And he called him like Hamilton and like,
yes, it was just, he did.
Just made me laugh out loud.
Oh yeah. Allison with a Y recognized whatever the vampire said he was wearing, right?
Yeah.
There was something where you were like, oh.
Yeah. I don't remember what it was, but okay. It was like a clothing term that I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like French aristocrat article of clothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what made me cackle? There's this whole sequence in the church where the trio goes to church just so they can, like, basically steal holy water and Eucharist crackers from the church. That was a really funny sequence.
Yeah, as they try to pull this all off under the watchful eye of Pastor, I don't know what
Pastor
what,
Method Man.
Would that have been his title, Pastor? Yeah, I don't know. He had a collar. Is that
he
would
have been a priest, I think.
Priest, okay.
Yeah. Father, yeah.
Oh, right, because it's a Catholic church.
Catholic, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were definitely all Catholic. I recognized a lot of those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very, very Catholic.
All under the watchful eye of Father Method Man.
Yeah, Father Method Man has the congregation, like, sit, you know, close their eyes, sit in silent prayer, basically so he can snoop on the kids and see what they get up to, because he doesn't trust them.
Yeah, except they still manage to get all the way past him and back to the, you know, the chambers behind the altar. While he's like looking down, I mean, you know, it's silly, it doesn't make any sense, but it's fun, you know, it's funny. It gives you the moment of like Method Man, like looking up from, you know, having his eyes closed in prayer and then doing like a, you know, just raising one eyebrow very aggressively and going to look for the kids. It's just, it's fun. It's good stuff.
Another thing that made me laugh was the girl who had, so I guess this was, it wasn't pre-TikTok. TikTok was in its very early days, but she was live streaming on a service that was very much like TikTok. And she was crushing it, you know, but she was hilarious. She cracked me up. So she kind of provided like a narrator voice almost through the film of, you know, what's going on. This white business is coming through town. It's buying up all the businesses. Oh, shit. These kids think that these business owners are vampires. They're crazy. And like she provides kind of a running commentary, but in a way that feels really organic and really like well worked in, given, you know, that kids her age do this stuff. They live stream and they have, you know, their own little channels. And I loved it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it felt very much like a real life character you would find in that kind of neighborhood. You know, that kid with that sort of reporting hustle. You know, because there's been kids like that. I mean, even before everybody had a computer in their hands, there were kids going around snooping, reporting, you know, putting out their own little self-published kind of stories and like newsletters and stuff like that in neighborhoods. It's a wonderful trope that's based in things that like some kids actually do, and I loved having a character like that in there.
Well, it's another point where I feel like it's gotta be this. This whole thing feels so inspired by Do the Right Thing to me. Have either of you guys seen Do the Right Thing?
I have not. No.
Oh man, it's so fucking good. That's one of my favorite movies of all time. But I mean, Samuel Jackson plays a radio DJ, like very like local, like small neighborhood radio station DJ in that movie, and recurs throughout the movie sort of, you know, acting in that Greek chorus type of role where he's sort of narrating and commenting on the events of the story. And this character, was it Glow?
Glow TV.
Yeah, Glow TV. Wasn't her name Glow or something? I don't know. Whatever. The character was very reminiscent of that Samuel Jackson character from Do the Right Thing to me, which was fun.
I loved little Luis and that he was sort of the token, like, nerd horror movie kid. And he's reading Salem's Lot at the beginning. And then you just get one quick shot of the cover of the book. And I was like, fuck yeah, Stephen King nod.
Yeah. And he was like a cute nerd. You know, I mean, he was a stereotype, like an archetype to a certain degree. But he was nerdy in like a very fun, cute way. And it wasn't, you know, and I feel like this is something that's changed over time in movies in general, but he wasn't just like a laughing stock, you know.
Yeah. No,
he
knew, yeah, not at all.
He knew all the shit about vampires, and for the most part, his friends didn't react in a like, you fucking nerd, why do you know these things kind of way.
No, more just like, not at all.
Oh, what the fuck? Garlic kills vampires, you know?
Right.
Yeah, he became the like, teach us how to do this.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I loved that Blade is like a central text for this movie. It's like their instruction manual for how to fight vampires.
I mean, yeah.
It really made me want to fucking rewatch Blade. I love Blade. I was really sad. I think they were on the verge. Actually, I think, yeah, this probably would have fucked with their rating, but I think they are on the verge of the moment when he says, some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill, which is one of my favorite movie lines of all time. And I was like, say it.
That would have put them into R-rated.
Yeah, I don't think they could have gotten territory away with that if they were trying to maintain their PG-13 or TV-14 or whatever it is.
Did you guys think it was scary?
Not particularly. No. I mean, you know, it gets the mood. It gets the mood, yeah, of vampires creeping up on you and whatever. But I mean, if you've seen that in movies before, it doesn't like do anything wrong. It's playing with the genre trope of vampires, but I don't think it's really trying to scare you.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Definitely more comedy than horror for me, but like.
Yeah.
For sure.
Enough horror to be put in the horror category.
How about them themes? What did y'all think of how it dealt with its themes? Or I mean, there's one central theme, and it's gentrification.
I mean, I just thought it was like scathing of it in a lighthearted, funny way.
Mm-hmm.
It, you know, it wasn't trying to aggressively shame people so much as point out just the absurdity of it.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciated that. The how they handled it matched the tone of the film, and I think was an age-appropriate handling for who I think the target audience probably was.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thesis statement is pretty simple. Like, gentrification is bad, but I think it throws in a couple interesting notes towards the end that I'll get into in the spoiler room as far as how different members of society kind of get pulled into being agents of gentrification. That was interesting to me. We'll dig into it a little more. But overall, like, it's, again, it's just a very palatable movie about gentrification. Like, I think we're all pretty, like, well-versed in gentrification and what it is and the discourse around it. But I think somebody who isn't, which there's plenty of people out there for mm-hmm. sure, could watch this and, you know, get a sense in like kind of a fun and enjoyable way of how a pretty serious thing works. Like, and that's cool. You know, I like using comedy or horror to kind of dig into a pretty serious and kind of complex subject.
Right. And I like how, you know, we got to meet a couple of the owners of the businesses that, you know, get bought up and closed down to be gentrified. And, you know, the humanizing of the people who that happens to, and kind of like the different responses to the possibility of gentrification, where some people are like, I'm going to take my money and run.
Yeah.
You know, and it, rightfully so. That's their right to do that.
Yeah.
And then other people who are like, you can't buy me out no matter how much you offer. Like, I do this because I love this and I love being part of this community. And it was nice to get sort of the different reactions to it from within communities and from the people who, you know, are getting bought out or pushed out or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It kind of shows the, again, a broad spectrum of people in the neighborhood and a broad spectrum of experiences and broad spectrum of reactions to what's going on. You know, I think it's very smart in that way. And it's crazy because this movie is so fucking short. Mm-hmm. It's under an hour and a half. And there's so much, so many characters, so much going on. It's a densely packed hour and a half, but also doesn't feel like exhausting.
Right. It's a, yeah. It's a tight ass movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sure is.
I think I've realized that hour and a half long movies are my new favorite kinds of movies.
Yes.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Like anything beyond that, obviously some movies you just have to have more time, but like if you can pack a whole lot of goodness into an hour and a half and really like concentrate it and distill it down and it's still like a great, you know, storyline, well written, well acted. I mean, you have my vote. Hour and a half movies are the way to go.
Yeah. I go on this rant all the time, and I've probably gone on it on this show before, but my favorite kind of movies, 90-minute movies. My favorite kind of albums, 32 to 35-minute albums. My favorite kind of books, like 250 pages long. Like, I am a brevity slut. Podcasts.
Give it to them short and sweet, folks.
Podcasts. I love a podcast that's like a half hour, which this one is not. Ever.
No. It's not.
And this is why I don't listen to podcasts. As a podcast host.
It's really hard to find a 250-page book anymore. I'm trying to think back to the last like 20 books I've read, and none of them have been 250 pages. That would be such a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, I was maybe exaggerating a little bit because you're right, 250 is kind of hard to find. But if you're around like 300, that's still a sweet spot for me.
Yeah, that's and up a good to 400, spot for sure.
Then I'm like, this is long.
Stephen King hates to see you come in.
Yeah. And yet I keep coming back to him over and over and over again.
I know, same.
Well, speaking of keeping things short and sweet, should we review this?
Yeah, might as well.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, Patrick, you want to start us off? Would you view it, cue it, or screw it?
I would view it. I had a lot of fun with this. I don't have too much more to say other than what I've been saying for the past half hour or whatever. It's charming, fun, sweet, little spooky. Handles a serious political issue in what I think is a pretty smart, accessible, entertaining way. And I'm glad that I finally got around to seeing it after having it on my short list for like 5 years or whatever. Allison with an I, view it, cue it, or screw it.
I am also a view it. I was so delighted by this movie. I felt like I was smiling out loud, laughing out loud. I was like, I want to watch this with my daughter who's 16. I would recommend this to like my mild salsa horror friends. It's perfect mild salsa horror.
I forgot about the salsa scale.
The salsa scale, right?
I love the salsa scale.
Yeah, it's perfect mild salsa. And as a really, really proud New Yorker, I was just kind of beaming watching this whole movie. Like, I was just like, I miss New York so much. And this is so very, very New York, you know? Like, so, yeah, absolutely, all day. View it. Allison with Y, you picked this. What did you think of it?
I mean, of course I have to give it a view it. It was so charming. If I had a teenager, I would sit down and watch this with them. Or like a tween. It's so fun. It has a lot of heart. It's fast paced. It's funny. It hits the kind of lighthearted vampire genre really well. But yeah, like we said, with a really good message in there, particularly around community and community coming together. And that's a recipe for me to give anything a view it. So
yeah, we're back to a three-way view it. Yes. Yeah,
no, we're gonna have to start watching more shit because we're not giving too many glowing reviews on this podcast.
Allison with a Y, you keep picking good movies, I have to say.
What can I say? Magic touch. Anyways, so before we head down to the spoiler coffin,
The Nest. Are we nesting the nest?
Oh, spoiler nest. Yeah, because I guess a bunch of coffins in one place together is called a nest. Before we head down to the spoiler nest, don't forget to follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube at Amoncast, EHMONcast. You can also find us on TikTok at Amonpodcast. And you can join our Discord server to join in on conversations around the things that we've been watching and what people in our community have been watching outside of the podcast as well. And you can find the link to all of those things in our show notes.
Along with a link to our website where you can get merch with every horror movie on Netflix art that I did on it. I should design a new shirt. It's been the same design for a long time.
Hell yeah, Mr. Artist. You can do it.
Yeah.
Do it.
Listeners, if you have suggestions of what you want to see on an Amon shirt, let us know. Let me know.
All right. Well, we're going to grab our holy water, our Eucharists, and our steaks, and probably some garlic and crosses while we're at it, and head on down to the spoiler nest. See you there. Okay, so we've got our vampire hunting kit. We are down in the spoiler nest.
And this holy water is boiling.
It's boiling. Fun fact, apparently holy water not only hurts vampires, but it boils when it's near them.
That was a new one to me. Like, so much of the vampire hunting and detecting stuff in this was, you know, standard shit that I've wooden stakes and whatever that I've seen before. I don't know if I've seen this holy water boiling thing specifically before. Is that a trope?
I feel like I have heard of that one before. Okay. But it's not like as common.
Yeah,
no, that was new cool. For me too.
It was cool because they have like water balloons full of holy water and it's like boiling. It's like a vampire detector basically.
I loved the water balloons full of holy water. I thought that was so like Home Alone coded or just
yes,
like, these kids were fucking smart with it.
yeah.
But yeah, a lot of our spoilers kind of revolve around the kids stealing a weird, spooky looking black, sort of like granite, maybe, key that has a skull on the tip. It looks very cool.
Very cool key. I would love to have a key like that just to put around the house.
And they have no idea what it is. But no, it is.
It was an accident. They didn't mean to.
Yeah, but it is very important to the vampires and their plan. And frankly, but I didn't entirely understand it. So maybe someone else can explain it. It unlocks a box that's full of like red dust that I guess is the ashes of the original vampire.
Yeah. So the red dust can help create more vampires, which is why the vampires wanted access to it.
Right. Because unlike some vampire movies, biting their victims does not turn them.
Correct.
It just merely kills them. So there's a whole different process to turning a victim into a vampire.
Okay.
Yeah. And they were buying up the properties to create more nests so that they could turn more people into vampires.
Yeah. Okay.
And have a home for their people.
Yeah. I got that piece with the property, but I, for whatever reason, it didn't click in my stupid brain until this moment that they don't really work like normal vampires do. They use dust to transform people instead of biting them.
Yeah.
Like blood dust.
Blood
ash,
dust.
Yeah, it's ash, I guess, not dust. But yeah, blood. Ugh. It was cool. It was like bright red sand.
But then not too long after the kids get the key, well, you know, then the vampires are on to the kids, okay? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, our boy Tony, this was the most devastating part of the movie for me. He gets got by Queen Bitch Vivian.
Right. Who has seemed like just kind of a supporting character for most of the movie.
Like a nice white lady who moved into their neighborhood. She's too nice. No, she didn't belong there.
I figured she wasn't going to be like all good, but I did not expect her to be like the vampire queen, the head honcho, basically.
I knew it as soon as... I knew it. I knew it.
I don't know who that actress is.
Vibe.
Yeah, the first time she showed up on screen, I was like, is that Ariana Grande? Just for a split second. She had that like same like thin face and that really like blonde hair and that really, really light skin. And we know now why she was extra white is because she was a vampire, but she was so also extra white, like just as a person. She offered to make like maple scones to bring to the fucking save the bodega party. I'm like, oh God, you're not even trying to assimilate.
She was way too aggressively nice. I was like, no way. No way.
So her name is Sarah Gadon or Gadon, and she's actually been in a few things that I've seen. She looked super familiar to me, so I looked her up last night. She's been in a few David Cronenberg movies, including A Dangerous Method, Cosmopolis, Maps to the Stars. And also, bring it back to Stephen King. I feel like we don't go an episode without saying Stephen King's name at least once for some reason.
As we shouldn't.
But she played Sadie in the 11/22/63 miniseries, which I haven't seen. But
I haven't seen it either, but it's my favorite Stephen King book so far.
Oh, mine too.
Yeah, she was just that white woman that, like, I think why you said this at the beginning, you were like, don't trust her. As soon as she showed up, I was just like, no, 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 no. And she ends up getting Tony, and he had just figured out, like, he was really skeptical of the kids, and he was kind of like, not trying to invalidate them, but also be like, come on, guys, like, this isn't a thing. There's no vampires here. Your imagination's getting the best of you. And then the old vampire trope of they don't have a reflection, so she didn't show up in his security mirror in his bodega. And just when he realizes that she's a vampire and grabs his, like, prized Sammy Sosa baseball bat that you could tell is just coveted by him, and he grabs it to kill her. And, man, for a minute there, I really thought he had a fighting chance.
Yeah.
I really wanted him to live.
I know.
I was actually a little surprised by that. I thought that, like, he would maybe sort of get away by the skin of his teeth, but, yeah.
Got to teach the kids about grief and loss, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's another element about this film that was interesting was the sort of, I mean, there are all these missing person signs. People are talking about are people going missing in the neighborhood, but there wasn't panic. It was just like, oh, yeah, there's just more people missing than usual. You know, just like people who have, I don't know, have just had to deal with violence coming to their neighborhoods for so long, just becoming desensitized to it.
Yeah. And also that Bobby character, one of the kids, you know, it's alluded to, and if not outright said, that his dad was a gangbanger and he was shot and killed. And that's sort of partly what I was referring to earlier in the episode when I said that that young actor dealt with that role and that storyline that's so heavy and nuanced. He did such a great job with it. And there's a moment at the end of the movie where somebody says to him, like, you're going to end up, you know, dead and shot just like your dad. And it, like, takes him aback in a very authentic way. I mean, that was a really well-acted scene, in my opinion, of a kid that's like, don't talk about my dad, you know, like. Mm-hmm. This is a truly, like, there's a lot of grief.
Yeah, so, I mean, Vivian now in, like, full-blown villain mode, like, wearing, you know, the fucking crazy-ass vampire clothing.
All black leather.
Bangs out, yeah. Goes on the hunt for the kids. She does get the key from them.
Mm-hmm.
But at the last minute, basically the whole neighborhood turns up.
Yeah, well, yeah, because the kids go to the actual nest to, you know, because they're like, we're going to get the vampires.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? The kids take them out quite effectively, most of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They crushed it.
Yeah.
They're doing well, and then Vivian gets the upper hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then all their friends, family show up with, like, their baseball bats and their sharpened sticks of wood and, you know, whatever. And it's a very,
all,
you know,
of their crucifixes, because they're all
doesn't Method Man show up with one of those, like, giant, like, the really long, he tall does. Ones that they use in Catholic
all the
mass.
Abuelas are out there, like, with their crosses.
Oh my God, I love that scene where it seems like the kids are down and out, and then all of a sudden, you know, everybody from the neighborhood is just outside of the wall, and somebody goes, "What the fuck did she say about the Bronx?" And it's like, I cheered out loud. I was like, fucking get it. Like, yes, community. It was such a fun scene.
Yeah. It's a very fun, like, I am Spartacus kind of vibe. And then Lil Mare delivers the killing blow to Vivian with Tony's bat.
Oh.
And that bat shows up the very first fucking time you see Tony, and you know it's going to be a thing in a way that almost bothered me, but whatever. It was fine. It was cute.
I think, I understand what you mean. But again, like, my dad being like the most New Yorker that I've ever known, and also the biggest Yankee fan that I've ever known, has like a priceless baseball bat in his like Yankee memorabilia collection. Like, it is a very New York thing. Very, very New York.
Oh, I don't doubt that. It was more just, I was referring to the way like the dialogue really drew attention to it, where it's like, okay, why are you, like, clearly you're spending time on this because this is going to be a plot point at some point. And it's the thing, like, it's the climactic weapon used to take Vivian out. And then everybody's happy and they have a block party. No more gentrification. Gentrification is over.
At least not by the vampires. Vampires have been beaten.
And our girl, the live streamer, kind of does a final little message to the camera, you know, something along the lines of, like, we're ready for whatever invaders come next or something like that, which I don't think I had been quite as invested in that character up to that point, but it was a cute note to end the movie and a good, you know, good way to kind of just drive the final point home.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
Drive the point home.
Oh, like a wooden stake.
Yeah.
and he was on his bike, which I thought was so clever because nobody else could really get close to Vivian, but he flew in there on his bike with the bat attached to the front of it.
Yeah.
Well, should we drive a stake through the heart of this episode?
And kill it?
I mean, it does have to end at some point.
It does.
It cannot be immortal like a vampire.
Yeah, that's true.
Before we wrap up, I will be doing a little vampire hunting of my own in what is supposedly in Italy. What? I'm taking it abroad. Yeah. So supposedly there is a jewelry shop owned by what is rumored to be a vampire in Venice.
Oh.
And I have the address. And I think I'm going to go.
Whoa.
Oh, my God.
Huh.
I'm so sad. I'm mad I didn't know about that when Patrick and I were in Venice last year.
Yeah.
I'm certain that it's totally an urban legend, but I think I'm going to be in Venice and I have the address. So I'm like, why the fuck would I not stop by and see what this is all about and talk to this owner that doesn't keep shop hours during the day, supposedly.
Incredible.
Good for you, but I'm going to be keeping a wooden stake ready next time I see you.
I eat a lot of garlic.
Just in case. Yeah. Well, we're going to be missing you for the next few episodes here. You're going to have a nice long trip in Italy, and so I think you're going to be out for our August episodes, but you'll be back in September. So we're gonna miss you, but we're gonna look forward to hearing all about the vampire jewelry store when you come back.
Yes,
I'll miss you too.
Mm-hmm. We're gonna be missing our beloved Allison with an I. It's not the same without the two Allisons, but we will be having some special guests come in.
To fill the void in our hearts.
To fill the void in our hearts, exactly. And Patrick, what are we going to be watching next?
We are going to be watching Ziam. That's Ziam. It is a Thai film. It's an N film, Netflix original. And the synopsis of it is a dystopian apocalypse, a swarm of horrifying zombies, a thrilling fight for survival. Can an ex-Muay Thai fighter escape danger before it's too late?
Ooh. Okay.
So it's like a martial arts movie. It's like kicking zombies in the head.
Okay.
And I am unreasonably excited about it. I had not heard of it until today, and I was just browsing around. I was like, what the fuck is Ziam? Which And at first I was like, how do you pronounce that? Like, you know, I'm probably going to mispronounce, but it is Siam because it's referring to the former name of Thailand, Siam, with a Z for zombies. Oh,
clever.
Incredible.
So I'm very excited about that.
Okay, well, I think that about wraps it up for every horror movie on Netflix this week. But just as a reminder, you can find us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, Blue Sky, YouTube, at Amoncast, EHMONCAST, and on TikTok at Amon Podcast. And then you can also join our Discord to discuss horror movies, what we're watching on here, what we're watching outside of here, what we're reading, listening to, all of that fun stuff. You can find the Discord server link in our show notes.
We'd also love for you to visit our website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com, and follow us on your podcast provider of choice. Leave us a review. We love to see that feedback from you, and it helps people to find the show.
For Every Horror Movie on Netflix, I've been Allison with a Y.
Allison with an I.
And I'm Patrick.
Bye.
Bye.